Everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann, and very interesting show today on Veterans Day. The first thing is that it's Veterans Day, and I've done an article today in Counterpunch, which I really want to again and again and again thank my editor, Jeffrey Sinclair, some of whom you've heard on the show, for publishing my stuff. And the article is called Veterans, Your Only Real Friend is the Anti-War Movement. It actually says love for the vets and GIs on Veterans Day. Your only real friend is the anti-war movement. I'm going to read you the opening of it and hope that you go on Counterpunch and see the whole thing. But the main conversation today is going to be with Roxine Dunbar Ortiz, who's just written an amazing, amazing book called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. We've known each other for a long time, and I'm going to be very happy to talk to her and learn from her on the show. And then if there's a little maybe time late at the very end, I may read a little bit more from my article. But the main thing is you can go on Counterpunch and read it yourself. So I think I said this is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines, Tuesday at 4. And Roxanne, are you with us already?
I am.
Great. Really looking forward to it. So I'm going to just read a little bit, and then I'm going to introduce Roxane Dunbar Ortiz. I'm going to spend almost the whole hour talking with her about both an indigenous people's history in the United States and the present state of the indigenous movement, because on Voices from the Front Lines, the biggest issue is the front lines. So it's Veterans Day, and I think for a lot of us on KPFK, we understand, frankly, the fraud of Veterans Day, but it's really important to understand the difference between the system's fraud and the very real veterans who are out there, who are working class people who were, for the most part, manipulated and used by just a filthy, brutal system, sent into wars of aggression that, as we'll see when we talk about Roxane's book, the early settlers who were just so phenomenally brutal and were in the whole tradition of essentially wiping out entire populations. But these are people that we use. They're not the same as the settlers who went and just grabbed the land. These are frequently people that have been either drafted or in the so-called all-volunteer army, pretty desperate, lonely people who have very little going in their lives, who've been sent into a system to kill and be killed. And I just want to read you a little opening from my article, and then we'll do an introduction of Roxane Dunbar Ortiz and get to the main conversation. So, it starts out, love for the vets and GIs on Veterans Day. Veterans, your only real friend is the anti-war movement. And again, it's in counterpunch.com. There are at least three gifts we can give to the veterans and GIs on Veterans Day. One is to bring all the troops home. Close down all 800 U.S. military bases. Provide jobs or income now. And the most extensive program of medical and psychological support for the vets and the entire working class. And demand that our government apologize to the peoples and nations all over the world for its wars of aggression, and apologize to the working class men and women it sent to kill and be killed to expand its empire. The second is to restore the historical record of the great movement against the war in Vietnam and its profound support of the troops. That movement, demanding U.S. out of Vietnam, bring the troops home, included perhaps 100,000 or more men who were drafted, refused, served, organized in the army, deserted, went into exile, rebelled, and upon return opposed the war with all their might. The troops were a critical component of the anti-war movement and must be again. Third is to support the work of Iraq Veterans Against the War, www.ivaw.org, who opposed the endless Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama world wars, and support the people of Ferguson and Palestine in the long tradition of courageous anti-war work throughout the U.S. history. You have to read their Fort Hood testimonies report, heartbreaking and courageous testimonies of GIs at Fort Hood, Texas, about the profound brutality of the U.S. Army towards its own soldiers, as the, quote, all-volunteer army is driven to carry out acts of terrorism against civilian populations by the commanding officer, producing countless deaths followed by catastrophic injuries in the line of duty, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, guilt, and despair. Brandon Harris, just one among the GIs whose riveting testimony is presented, states, "I in no way am proud of my deployments anymore. I absolutely think that every single deployment I went on did more harm than good without question." This is critical work, that of IBAW, as the U.S. cynically generates mock outrage against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban, who it uses interchangeably as enemies and allies, as pretext for its effort at world domination. So again, the system trots out its cruel and hypocritical Veterans Day, a hollow spectacle in which the war industry tries to justify and perpetuate centuries of racism, conquest, genocide, and crimes against humanity, and its perpetual war state. What a sad, hypocritical system celebrating the men and women who have risked life, limb, mental, and physical health for an endless series of unjust wars that the U.S. turns on and off like a faucet, all for the sake of a declining empire and the profits and egos of a very sick ruling class. As an organizer and strategist, I see our present condition defined by what I call the system's counter-revolution against the great revolution of the two decades of the 60s, led by the Vietnamese and Black Liberation Movement. Like others who share my politics, we see that revolution beginning in 1955 with the Bandung Conference of Non-Aligned Nations, the Montgomery bus boycott, and the murder of Emmett Till, and ending in 1975 with the Vietnamese victory over the U.S., given that all revolutions begin as ideas in the minds of revolutionaries. The system is working 24/7 to suppress the people, the history, and the ideas that led to a worldwide united front against what we called, and should still call, U.S. imperialism. Well, I just realized in reading this, Roxanne, that this certainly is an introduction to our relationship, which goes back almost 50 years, I think, or at least 40, and an introduction to your terrific, terrific book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. So in terms of just a very short introduction, I'm going to read Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Grew up in rural Oklahoma, daughter of a landless farmer and half-Indian mother. Roxanne took a position teaching in a newly established Native American Studies program at California State University at Hayward near San Francisco, helped to develop the Department of Ethnic Studies as well as Women's Studies. In 1974, she became active in the American Indian Movement, AIM, and the International Indian Treaty Council, beginning a lifelong commitment to international human rights. Her first published book, The Great Sioux Nation, An Oral History of the Sioux Nation and a Struggle for Sovereignty, was published in 1977. It was presented as the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indians in the Americas, held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. That book was followed by two others in the following years, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, 1680-1980, and Indians of the Americas, Human Rights and Self-Determination. Roxanne, it's great to have you on the show.
It's really good to be on your show, Eric.
Well, I think the last time I remember seeing you in great detail was at the World Conference Against Racism, I think, on the plane.
That's right. And now and then, I think we bumped into each other at the conference.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. So given your rich history, I just want to start by just saying absolutely congratulations on the book. I mean, I don't want to overdo superlatives, but it's a pretty incredible document, beautifully written. Obviously, I've almost had a fear of reading about Native American in some way because it's just so heartbreaking that I just remember once when I went on a jag of reading, you know, several books, of course, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and went on sort of a short Native American studies self-tutorial. And it's such a rich, phenomenal history, such a complex history. And of course, it is the ultimate sin upon which U.S. imperialism was based. So I think my first question to you is that in the first chapter about the indigenous cultures themselves, why don't you tell our listeners about the 100 million people who were in the Americas before the first genocidal Europeans showed up?
Yes, that first chapter I call Follow the Corn because corn, or maize as some call it, is the sacred food that is really the product, the invention of Native American agriculturalists out of Mexico, Mesoamerica, that spread in every direction, spread all the way north to the subarctic and south to Tierra del Fuego and from ocean to ocean, so that by the time the Europeans came, there were three sites of advanced agricultural civilizations out of nine that are identified in the world. Two are in China, and two are in Africa, and one in Mesopotamia. But there were three in the Americas, in the Andes, in central Mexico, and the entire eastern half of what is now the United States. We know about Mexico and the Andes, but because of Anglo-imperialism and its mythology about native peoples, we have been deprived of real knowledge of the amazing nations and communities that existed in what is now the United States and North America. But it can't be separated from the rest, because before the Europeans came, of course, the Spanish came first, and the French and the British and the Portuguese in the south. There were roads crisscrossing both continents. There was a road like the Pan American Highway today. It follows the same road from Alaska to western Mexico, and then roads that went inland from there and on down into South America. And in North America, going east and west, roads connecting everyone together. So I think we had this mythology of these sort of Neolithic hunters all separated from each other and having no contacts at all. There were huge trade networks. All this has been known, you know, archaeological sites. It's not like I had to go out and do archaeology to find this information. It's there, but it never appears in textbooks. It never appears in any popular literature, because that would shake up the mythology of empty land, very few people at all. And they were all wiped out by smallpox before anything happened. And, of course, that also a myth. So, yeah, before the Europeans came, there was something going on in the Western Hemisphere that we need to really look back at, because civilizations that did not lead to capitalism were not leading to capitalism. They weren't pre-capitalist. They were collective in the most advanced ways that we can hardly even imagine now. And we have, I consider myself a great admirer of Marx, but the universalizing of stages of development that lead inevitably to capitalism, and that socialism cannot come until that happens, is just simply nullified with the knowledge of what was going on in the Western Hemisphere for tens of thousands of years, you know, before the Europeans came. And there were many different ways of getting to democracy and collective social relations, not just one, different kinds of governance, different kinds of ways of food distribution. But one thing they all had in common were matriarchal formations. And I like to clarify that matriarchal is a problematic word, because it is opposed to patriarchal. But a patriarchal system is a pyramid system of classes and castes, and better and worse, superior and inferior, poor and rich. Whereas matriarchy isn't just a replacement of women in those situations, those in that gradation. Rather, it's really democracy. And I think this is because they understood the biological limitations of both genders, and also their capacity, but the capacity to bear children at a certain fairly short period of life for women, at least one period of their life. Everything was built around the raising of children and the care of people. And
Roxanne, let me hold you there for a minute, because I want to ask a couple of questions building on that. You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and we're discussing her book, An Indigenous Peoples History of the United States. Let's deal a little bit more with the actual technical advances of indigenous culture. So I have three questions, actually, in a row. Tell us a little bit about the actual chronology of the Bering Strait. How many years are we talking about the evolution of indigenous cultures in the Americas before the first imperialist intervention?
Well, this is, of course, debated. It's changed tremendously, you know, since Native people organized and put pressure on for, you know, really posing questions. First, the Bering Strait theory is of populating the Americas. It's a very political theory. There was this land bridge 11,000 years ago, so it's so dependent on there being no population in the Western Hemisphere before 11,000 years ago, and that is so disproven that it's, and yet you will be called anti-science if you question the Bering Straits theory. But it's as if, you know, the imaginary of what Native Americans were capable of doesn't include being in the water. Somehow all the other people in the world were fishermen and had ships and boats and traversed the oceans, the whole Pacific populated by peoples in boats. And yet these people surrounded by these two gigantic oceans, and of course the Caribbean Sea, they were scared of the water apparently, because they couldn't possibly have come in and across on boats and traveled around, that they had to have an ice bridge to walk across. So, you know, that's why I say it's a political thesis. And there's still absolutely, you know, archaeology is very expensive, like most sciences. It takes government grants or corporate grants to carry out long-term, you know, in isolated areas often, and with technology that's very expensive. And there is no money for research for the populating of the Americas. Thor Heyerdahl, of course, on his own, the Scandinavian, did the experiment that showed very clearly from the Pacific coast of Peru to the Pacific Islands that there was absolutely no doubt that people migrated in both directions from there. We know we have a lot about the oral tradition in northern California, of the Rainbow Bridge, which is, you know, the similarities between Hawaiian Native people and Northern California people. So, and the same on the other side, on the Atlantic. There are a lot of South Asian scholars, some Egyptians, looking into voyages. Of course, the way they frame it is that they discovered America. You know, it's always still putting it in terms of discovering, and not that there could have been exchanges. And since that's what everyone else was doing in the world, and Native Americans were human beings, that it's just pretty clear that they were trading on the seas as well as on land with the roads.
So we are challenging, you know, at least 11,000, but as you point out, since obviously there's been all kinds of history of people showing up at places much earlier than we thought. Let's assume that we even can, you know, totally agree with the idea of rejecting the Bering Strait theory, really. And so let's move to whether it's 11,000, I don't mean it's unimportant, or 20,000. Let's move to, and I mean it's very important to challenge the Bering Strait theory. So that's one point we'll go back to or go forward from. The second is, let's talk about, for our listeners, how evolved these civilizations were. Let's talk about technology. Let's talk about agriculture. Let's talk about irrigation. Let's talk about art. Just give us a little sense of the fully evolved nature of some of the civilizations inside the Americas.
Yeah, and this is tied together, the time scale, because, you know, all the studies of corn and its origins, for one thing, of the wild form of corn does not exist. Almost every grain and every berry and every fruit has a wild form that still exists. For the corn, it's apparently so ancient that it hasn't been found. There's one little rock saying that is, it looks like it could have been a, you know, a fossil of a tiny piece of corn that is tens of thousands of years old. But corn was clearly highly developed, was already developed in Mesoamerica 10,000 years ago. So it's just unlikely that and corn does not exist on any other continent. It didn't come from Asia. It wasn't brought along. It was literally cultivated, and they don't know the wild form. So that's why I named the chapter Follow the Corn.
Right,
not only
right.
is it the sacred food, it also is the evidence that agricultural development that belies, you know, the idea of recent entry, because the civilization in Central Mexico was already developing, and out of that, you know, it was the center, just like, you know, Africa. I mean, there are certain centers where developments occur and then spread elsewhere. So everything did spread out of Central Mexico, south and north and east and west. But we have to find, you know, ways to follow the languages, to do research and find. I'm very interested in how these migrations took place. We do know that the people of the southeast of what is the U.S. now, the Muscogee people and the Cherokee people, have their oral tradition is they came from Central Mexico, and the Cherokees even have stories that they came from further south in the Andes and crossed through Mexico north. So we have, you know, the oral tradition is extremely important for tracing these things. But yes, by 5,000, 6,000 years ago, they had in Mexico, in Peru, they used terraced farming, much like Japan. In North America, in the southwest, what's now the southwest of North America, is one of probably the most developed irrigation systems, miles and miles long, 15 feet diameter, waterproofed irrigation in a desert area. So when we look at the Nile River development, Mesopotamia, we see a desert with irrigation and the high civilization. This is also true in southern China. So these are the mark of, you know, how agriculture began, strangely enough, not in well-watered areas, but in desert areas with irrigation. Now, the idea of Oriental despotism that Marx tended to refer to, of, you know, having to have large-scale slave labor to build large works, that is also belied by the way in which the Pueblo Indians and the, you know, the Indians of the Southwest still operate their irrigation systems, although they're not nearly as vast now. Much was destroyed there by the Spanish. They reduced 98 city-states to 21 within about 30 years and simply appropriated them, made them Spanish towns. But they had very democratic, I did a whole book on it called Roots of Resistance, The History of Land Tenure in New Mexico. So that was the most highly developed. But in Mexico and Peru, they had different, they're all dry areas. So it's only when they get to the eastern part of North America, from the Iroquois Confederation down to the, you know, Gulf of Mexico to the Mississippi Valley, an incredible agricultural area of villages and federations of villages, farming villages. So the people who were, the, you know, felt the brunt of Anglo-colonialism, British colonialism first were these people, and then especially the founding of the United States. They wanted that rich land for plantation, slave works plantations. So, of course, they removed all of the native nations from the East Coast and appropriated that land. But it actually came later, the well-watered land. So the technology required for desert farming, you know, to, and corn was just one of the part of a triad of beans and squash, which includes pumpkins. And so each of these, the corn, there were about 90 different colors and varieties of corn, about the same number of beans, different kinds of beans, with squash. I mean, around this time of year, they bring things out they call Indian corn, Indian squash, and you see examples of a few of those different colors, shapes, and sizes. But each had different nutrients, and the three together make a perfect protein. So people in those agricultural areas, they eat some meat, especially when in winters when stores of the, you know, of agriculture might get low, then they would supplement with meat. But they largely had a very healthy vegetarian diet and lived a long time. The other thing they developed, which Europe didn't for an awfully long time, is hygiene, ritual bathing, and actual cleanliness bathing at many times a day, which the Europeans found grotesque, that they're always in the water, always bathing, cleaning themselves. And so they had good protection against diseases. There were diseases, and they had ways of fight. They had medicine. They had, you know, famously in central Mexico and all up into Northern California and the Southwest, they had dentistry. There are archaeological digs of bones, of skulls that have obvious work done on the teeth.
And hold it there again, Roxanne. I mean, one thing I want to do, you're listening to an Indigenous People, History of the United States, that's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. I want to move a little faster, if it's okay, Roxanne, because okay. I want to move a set of questions in some sequence, and we have a half an hour left, and I want to make sure some of the key points you want to make are made. So what was the total number of people estimated in the Americas before the, whether it's 1492 or the exact, you know, moment of the European invasion? What's the general accepted number of indigenous people from all the way from Alaska to the tip of South America?
Well, I think a group of the most capable demographers have settled on about 100 million. It may come to be seen as more. The devastation of colonialism makes it hard to see those numbers because that many people can't be outright killed. So genocide takes different forms, and one form is at least the first century of both Spanish and British intervention. Indians were enslaved and transported Native people, and the Spanish were up in North America too. So, for instance, this very advanced Natchez Nation of 2 million people in cities in the Mississippi Valley, they were invaded by Spanish slave hunters, and practically the whole population, as in western Nicaragua and western Honduras, were shipped to the mines of Peru. So it's not as if,
wow.
I mean, sure, a lot of those people died, and then
right,
they
right.
died overwork in the mines, but they weren't killed per se. So neither by disease nor, you know, by gunfire, they were enslaved. So those light populations is true of West Africa. It's still, you know, a man-to-land ratio is still less because of that early devastation starting 1454 when the Portuguese was given permission to enslave the people of West Africa. So the population may come to be even more as we, I think, DNA testing, if they ever do it, you know. The thing is they have to have this mindset, of which I try to present here, of looking for things, you know. It won't just happen unless they look for the descendants of the Natchez people in, you know, in the Peruvian population, the Andean population. But I think the numbers will go even higher. Now, breaking it down...
And hold on. I just want to keep moving, Roxanne, okay, because that's great. So the main point is that there's 100 million people that, just to give our listeners an understanding of the extensive population, is my point. These were not small hunter-gatherers, you know. Okay, so now I want to move in some way fast forward to still. Let's discuss the section where you discuss Wounded Knee from 1890 to 1973. Why don't you talk about what you think the political frame is for that political conversation? Help our listeners understand the politics of what you're arguing for in your book.
Yeah, this is very appropriate for us to be talking about this on Veterans Day, because, you know, the military theme in this book is actually the main theme of U.S. history, because this is an indigenous people's history of the United States, and the history of the United States is a history of militarism, and we don't conceive the United States that way, but it is, you know, the heart of what the United States is, and it keeps playing out that way, but, you know, it's never seen as being rooted in the Indian Wars, and the Indian Wars started in Jamestown, you know, in 1607, not just, you know, in the plains. So they're all wars against the Indians. And Wounded Knee, 1890, is a very good example of U.S. militarism, because there 300 starving Sioux refugees were trying to turn themselves in to the government so they could get food. It was December 30th. It was 40 below zero, cold as only South Dakota can be. And they were surrounded by the 7th Cavalry, which was Custer's old cavalry. And because, you know, Custer had been killed and defeated, the 7th Cavalry defeated, it was it's thought to be pretty much a revenge action of surrounding these unarmed, starving people who hadn't eaten for weeks, babies dying, many of them just very elderly people, small children, and they surrounded them, set up their Hotchkiss guns, which are these, you know, automatic cannons, not that much different. They did as much damage then as they do now, and simply started firing on them and killed over 300 of these people. A few of them were able to run and escape, and then they buried them in a mass grave. That incident, which generally people accept civilians as a massacre, could only be described as such, is actually in the U.S. Army annals, is listed as a battle, not a massacre, and a battle won, you know, on the win and loss side.
Right.
Win and loss and draw. And in the military schools, this is what they teach. This is one of the battles. And some dozens, I may be exaggerating, but I think about 80 or so, but it's like the majority of the troops got medals of honor, congressional medals of honor, for that, quote, battle, and they've never been rescinded. So that's the nature of the U.S. military right there. And then in 1973, when the Sioux people rose up again at Pine Ridge and they went to Wounded Knee, to this place where the mass grave is, and they called attention, you mentioned Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That book had come out the year before, and so people knew that word. It was a very popular bestseller, a very important book at an important time, and it told the story of Wounded Knee. So they took their stand there of what they were demanding, you know, the return of the Black Hills, that the U.S. honor the 1868 peace treaty that the Sioux signed, land be restored, that the puppet government that was repressing the people on the reservation, that they be able to elect their own government. In other words, that the colonial system be removed and they be free. It was a knee-jerk reaction. Nixon in the White House, and of course in Vietnam, they're trying, 73, they're still, of course, bombing to smithereens in Vietnam, and combat veterans are still there, or combat fighters. And he, you know, just a knee-jerk reaction, sends out the 82nd Airborne Army, divisions, plus every other kind of, you know, state police, federal police, National Guard, and surrounds the place and locks the people in. So actually it was a siege. It's often called an occupation, but they didn't go there to occupy. They went there to hold a press conference and tell, you know, what their complaints were to the media. And but that was the reaction. It's still, you know, in the DNA and the memory of the militarism, you know, the military of the United States, of that, you know, another Indian war. And it was so revealing. It was quite extraordinary because the pictures of the 1890 massacre started circulating again on posters and all, where the people were all, you know, these dead bodies of women and children, old people in a ditch, in this shallow grave, just throwing them in a ditch. And it was almost identical to that famous My Lai, those famous My Lai pictures of the Vietnamese women, children, older people in a ditch, and they started putting them side by side, you know. So it was such an important moment of understanding the U.S. military that in the meantime we seem to have forgotten. Those of us who understood that have, been sidelined. So generations now really don't have access to that kind of information. That's really why I decided to write the book, you know, these wars and this counterinsurgency coming up again. And if you know the history of the U.S. military and Native people, you know, in taking this continent, you have to know that that is the basis, the very basis of what the United States is, its trajectory, that what it's doing now is a trajectory from that time.
So that was great. Roxanne, we have about 3 more minutes, and then I'm going to move to some commentaries on Veterans Day. What would you say? I mean, obviously, folks, I'm a big proponent of getting this book. I mean, I think it's essential that people get this book. The level of detail, I was just thinking, we just were discussing with Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch, we were discussing Vijay Prashad and Robin D.G. Kelly about the sort of the complexity of broad brushstrokes and phenomenal attention to detail. And I would put you in that category because this book has a sense of just phenomenal theoretical breadth, poetic writing, and as you've heard today, just a great, great attention to specific detail. So in the blurb world of revolutionary organizing, in your last 2 minutes, what would you say to people is the main contribution you wanted this book to make?
Well, I want people to know, you know, that first chapter, setting it up, and I refer to it throughout, what was lost to humanity in, you know, in the colonization of the Americas, the first act of European capitalism, developed capitalism. Then I want to show how the United States was born as a ready-made empire. By 1801, it already had the Marines, and it was invading the North Africa, you know, not to speak of,
wow,
of the continent.
Right.
Three Barbary Wars, you know, and it continued, you know, never-ending. Imperialism from the very beginning.
That's right.
And also that it was born a pure capitalist state, the first pure capitalist state. So it's no accident that it is the headquarters of capitalism. And it took that mantle worldwide from Britain in the 1870s. I keep saying, you know, people say, well, it was after World War One. It wasn't. The United States had the highest gross national product by the 1870s. So that accumulation of land was the main commodity, and land was taken, you know, from Native people. The second main commodity, besides land, were human bodies, African bodies, or commodities, but they also were free labor in the sense of unpaid labor. So this, you know, this matrix of militarism, slavery, ownership of bodies, and taking the land, and the genocidal thrust of eliminationism, eliminating the native people to take the land. This is the core of what the United States is and what it's playing out over and over and over again in the world today. So it's not just history. You know, I am a historian, but in every chapter, you probably notice I try to relate it to the present.
Absolutely.
It's not just history. You need to know that history in order to understand the present, but it's very alive.
Well, I want to thank you a lot. I mean, I think one of the things I would say to our listeners, because you know that one of the themes of Voices from the Frontlines is the not simply revolutionary theory, but the theory based on the United States as a white settler state in its DNA and the construction of U.S. capitalism and U.S. imperialism, not sort of, and oh, by the way, there was slavery, or oh, by the way, there was indigenous genocide, but that the very construction of this country, the specific form of a racist pseudo-capitalism from a materialist point of view, which is what Roxanne is saying, is essential to how the United States was constructed. So I really want to thank you for being on the show. I want to urge our listeners, you got to get this book. It's just that good. And I did another hour of reading beforehand, Roxanne, just in, you know, to try to prep for the show. But I just want to say that it's so dense and beautiful that it's a book you have to read slowly, because almost every sentence is both theoretical and leading you to another concept. So I want to congratulate you on the book, congratulate you on a life still going very strong, and have you back on the show soon.
Good. Thank you so much, Eric. It was great to talk with you.
Take good care of yourself.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Again, please check out our website, because this interview and conversation will be up in a couple of days. And you can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. And I'd love if you would send me an email, eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Federico, how many minutes exactly do I have to read? So you'll give me some cues also. 6. So I'm going to see how well I can do it. I'm just going to pick a couple of spots from the article, because this is about Veterans Day again and supporting the veterans. But as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz just pointed out, the system is based on genocide. The system is based on mass murder. It's based on the wiping out of populations, of the exploitation of land, almost stripping the sovereignty from people and stripping, almost seeing the whole world simply as, I'm just thinking, Reverend Higgins said, the whole world is their marketplace. So, a couple of reads from this. I'm starting with a quote from Muhammad Ali, because the point again being the history of the anti-war movement and its relationship to GIs. So Muhammad Ali said, "I ain't draft dodging. I ain't burning no flag. I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine. You go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for 4 or 5 more, but I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you, if I want to die. You my enemy, not Chinese, not Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America for my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for my right here at home." From 1965 to 1967, I lived and worked in Newark's black community. This is me, Eric Mann, speaking. With the Newark Community Union Project, which had a program called No Rent for Rats, Let the People Decide, and was actively organizing against the war in Vietnam. As part of that broader strategy, I went into a local Newark draft board in an effort to organize draft resistance. I was not, in fact, a draftee, but I guess they never checked when I walked in, figuring no one would just walk in and all volunteer until drafted. They asked us to stand up and take an oath, and then, as sort of planned, I declared, "I refuse to fight in this unjust war. This is a racist war, sending us to fight against the people of Vietnam in the interest of big business and capitalism. I will not fight, or kill, or die. The Vietnamese people have the right to their own destiny, and the U.S. has no right to be in Vietnam in the first place. I urged my fellow draftees to follow me as I walked out, more relieved than militant. I had carried out the plan and wanted to get the hell out of there. To my surprise, a young black man stood up and said, "I agree with you, brother. I'm leaving too." When we got outside, I felt more guilty than elated. I said, "Listen, I wasn't drafted. I just came in as an anti-war organizer. I feel very badly I got you in trouble." It had not occurred to me that someone would walk out with me. He said, "I don't care who you are. I agree with you. What do we do now?" At first, I really had no idea. As I remember it, I had no contingency plan for success. Fortunately, I had the wisdom to call Lenny Wineglass, a young militant lawyer who was working with NCUP and would later defend the Chicago 7, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and many other great causes. Lenny said, "Come on over, we'll figure something out." Lenny worked with the young man, who I'll call Willie, and his mother, who was so happy her son had been encouraged to walk out. She militantly defended him in front of the draft board, and somehow Lenny, Willie, and his mother ended up avoiding the draft or prosecution. As Lenny and I kept in touch over the decades, he would always tell me, "I was just in touch with Willie, and he sends you his regards, and he thanks the movement for saving his life." So it's a complete lie that the anti-war movement was anti-GI. We had a great love for the people in the U.S. and Vietnam. We were encouraged by the Vietnamese who counseled us. The U.S. people and the GIs are the allies of the Vietnamese people. It is the U.S. government that's our enemy. We can hold out militarily, but we can only win national liberation if there's a successful movement of the people in the United States. As organizers with strong ties to the working class, Black, Latino, and Native American movements, we saw the GIs as political prisoners, and while not excusing the horrendous acts they were forced to carry out, let alone those who did so with gusto, we understood it was the system that trained them, indoctrinated them, who had contempt for them and the people of the Third World. That outrage led many of us to become revolutionaries. Okay, so then I guess I'm going to end with saying the punchline. On Veterans Day, there's only one way to stop the epidemic of post-traumatic stress disorder suffered by millions of vets. There's only one way to end the 25 to 50 suicides a day by veterans and to end the shame, guilt, and torment inflicted on GIs and veterans. There's only way to end the torture, brutality, and mass murder inflicted by the U.S. Armed Forces throughout the world, especially the Third World. We have to cut down U.S. invasions by 100%, close down U.S. military bases by 100%, and reduce the U.S. military budget for aggressive interventions by 100%. That is a war worth fighting for. So with that, I'm going to ask you again as we hear some Nina Simone. Please send me an email. I don't want to beg you, but it would be great if you did, at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Tweet me. And I'll read it next week at Eric Mann Speaks. I think next week we're going to have an actual benefit for the Pacifica Archives Project, in which we're going to do some great clips from the archives and encourage you to give money. That's a really great show. We love doing it. And last time we raised, I think, $4,570 or $5,470, but a whole lot of money. So, this is Eric Mann, the host of Voices from the Frontlines. I want to thank Federico, our engineer. I want to thank Alan Minsky, the program director at KPFK. And, of course, thank you, the listeners, because you're the folks that make this all worthwhile doing. Take good care. As we say, in the never gets old, all power to the people.